This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The last of 1,500 residents of Big Sur, California, were ordered to evacuate their homes yesterday, and while that area gets a lot of attention because of the spectacular scenery and cultural history, smoke chokes the air across much of Northern California. There are more than 1,500 fires, many caused by lightning, others by man, but all abetted by dry conditions. And the fire season has just started. So far, no one has been reported killed by the fires, but more than 50,000 acres have burned already. Thousands of men and women from all over California and neighboring states are doing their best on the fire lines, but with so many fires, they have to decide which to fight and which to let burn. Every summer, we hear variants of this story, sometimes in California or Colorado, Idaho or Arizona. But what's it like to fight brush and forest fires? What happens when you get the call? Today, we'll talk with a few of the men and women who fight fires from the air as well as from the ground. If you've been on the fire lines, call and tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also share your experiences on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, the politics, pride, and technology that went into the so-called man-machine system that carried man to the moon, Digital Apollo. But first, firefighters. And we begin in California with Del Walters, Assistant Regional Chief of the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. And Del, thanks very much for being with us today.
Good morning, Neil.
And what's the situation now?
The situation is that, as you mentioned, we had lightning almost 2 weeks ago now, and we're still have probably over 300 still uncontained. In other words, we don't have a ring around them just yet. But we're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. As you mentioned, we had well over 1,500 fires initially.
And are some of them out?
Yes. Yes, we have actually contained over 1,400 fires so far. This is statewide.
That's statewide. And
yeah,
that's
in the last 12 days.
And how many people have been involved in that effort?
Our estimate now is well in excess of 20,000 firefighters on the line today.
And where do they come from?
They came from all over the nation. We have representatives from firefighters from 41 of our states right here right now.
And are they professionals, volunteers, what?
Everybody. We pulled out all the stops on this one. We've got professionals, we've got volunteers, we've got contractors, we've got the military. You name it, there's a representation on these fires.
And when this you have those lightning strikes, as you mentioned, 2 weeks ago, and obviously you're awaiting reports to find out what's on fire where, but you begin marshaling this incredible logistical effort to get all these people in the right place.
Right. Initially, it's an operational consideration. Logistically, we have to support them. And the other thing is to have the capability of determining where all of these fires are. This is an extraordinary event that occurred in Northern California with the lightning that came in. Those of us who've been in this business for for almost 40 years now, and never seen anything quite like this.
And as I understand it, it's awfully early in the season for something like this,
That's part of what's occurred. And we had below normal precipitation in Northern California for 5 months, practically no precipitation whatsoever. We're experiencing firefighting conditions that we would not normally see until August.
So it looks like it could be a long, hot summer.
Oh, I'm afraid so.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we have to do with the firefighters, and we're doing it now. Some of them have been on the lines getting close to a month. And typically we try to rotate people off after a couple of weeks, but now we're putting our people 21 days and then giving them 48 off, except in some of the extremely smoky areas on the coast where we can only work them like 7 days and give them a day off out of the smoke.
And this is no small logistical operation to support those people, too. You've got to get food and shelter for them.
Right. We have bases set up all over Northern California right now. We have a total of, I think, right now, 17 teams on the ground with bases set up to feed them and rest them.
And are there different kinds of specialties involved here?
I beg your pardon?
Specialties? Do different skills come into this?
Oh, certainly. Because the organization itself, we use the incident command system to organize. And so you've got a command and general staff. You've got operations planning, the logistics itself, and then finance, because we certainly have to pay for all of this and keep track of that.
And so you have different, you know, obviously administrators and people on the fire lines. If they're volunteers, professionals presumably have a lot more experience and know what they're doing.
Presumably. However, we have got some very strong volunteer fire departments in our state, and I have to imagine that around the country that's the case as well. They have a certification system, and they we ensure that they have adequate training to safely operate on the fire lines.
And what kind of equipment do they bring with them?
We have, once again, everything from Type 1 engines, which are like your structure protection engines in a metropolitan area, down to a Type 6 engine, which is a pickup with a pretty good-sized water tank in the back. And they all have a place in these types of fires. And then dozers, we have fire crews that cut fire line. We have aircraft of all types that are fighting the fires now as well.
Well, he mentioned aircraft. By the way, if you've been involved in fighting a forest fire, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Joining us now from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento is Bill Payne, Deputy Chief of Flight Operations for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. And thanks, Bill Payne, very much for being with us today.
Oh, happy to be here, Neil.
Tell somebody who knows absolutely nothing about this, why can't you just take up a whole bunch of water and put out the fires?
Well, we're doing that. We're taking up a whole bunch of water, but we're doing it little bites at a time. Anything from 185 gallons on the smaller helicopters up to 12,000 gallons with the DC-10.
With a DC-10?
Yes, sir. We put the DC-10 in service 2 years ago, and it's the only what we call very large or super tanker in the world, actually, that's fighting fires. And it's been very effective on the larger fires.
And how does that drop? This is an airline, a converted airliner. From what altitude does it drop water?
That's correct. It drops 12,000 gallons. It has three separate tanks on the bottom of the aircraft. It comes in at 200 feet, 143 knots in landing configuration, and it'll put down a line of retardant, about 50 to 75 feet wide and 3/4 to a mile long.
This is a big old, the DC-10, as I recall, is a three-engine jet. A big old jet coming in at 200 feet?
Oh, it's an impressive sight. And once you get used to it, the firefighters are loving it because it's putting down a whole lot of retardant.
We do see pictures also of flying boats, the old Martin flying boats who go down and scoop up water from a lake.
That's right. Last year on the Southern California siege, we brought the Martin Mars down out of Canada. And it did a real good job in San Diego. It did such a good job, we put it up on Shasta Lake now, and it's fighting on the Shasta Lightning Complex fire out of Shasta.
And that's a big four-engine job, too. Does it also come in at 200 feet?
Oh, you bet. And it pulls up 7,200 gallons of water.
That can't be. Why does it have to be so low?
Well, you have to have it in a place where it's not going to be blown off the fire by the wind. Quite often in fire conditions, you have windy conditions. And you want to get the water to come out of the airplane and then stop and then go straight down on the vegetation. You'd go much higher than that, it'll get blown away and diffused, and you won't get the volume where you need it.
And is it dropped on the fire, or is it dropped ahead of the fire to make the vegetation wet so it won't burn so easily?
With the Martin Mars, we're just dropping water because of where it is in a sensitive area, so it's dropping directly on the fire. With the DC-10, we're putting a line of retardant out in front of the fire and letting the fire burn up to the retardant.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Again, if you've been involved in fighting a forest fire up from the ground or from the air, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Victor's on the line. Victor's calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello. Good to talk to you guys.
Go ahead, please.
Well, the first fire I went to when I was 14 was a brush fire that we were trying to keep from turning into a forest fire. I turned the pressure up too high, blew a hose off the truck, had to back away from the truck of the fire, reattach another hose as we watched our first hose burn up.
Can't have been an auspicious start.
It wasn't a good start, but I all was forgiven, and a little more training was involved, and never made the same mistake twice.
It sounds as if you've been to more than a few fires since then.
Most of the time it was since I was a teenager. I live in Portland, Oregon now. This was all in southern Oregon until it turned about 22 and left the area.
And what's the experience like?
Well, at first, everything's go, go, go. You're all adrenaline, and you're just whacking and trying to put this stuff down. And then you realize you're just bone tired. It's hot. It's dirty. It's nasty. Your eyes, everything stings. And it takes days to get that smell out of your hair and your skin.
I wonder, Del Walters, does that sound familiar?
Oh, it sounds very familiar. And, you know, one of the things we always tell our people is that you can't rely on your water to save you. So that's I've had that happen myself, and you have to constantly be aware of your surroundings and maintain your safety awareness.
And that must be get harder and harder as you get tireder and tireder.
Absolutely, and that's why we have to pace ourselves. I thought he explained it very well. Your adrenaline at a point, you have to realize that you have to pace yourself, and certainly in this situation we have out here, we're in it for the long haul. So that's a very serious consideration of ours.
But you've had hoses burn up too?
Oh, yeah.
So, Victor, you're not alone.
Nope.
Well, I wasn't the only one that burned up. My dad, who was the fire chief, managed to burn one up on a house fire.
That might be harder. Anyway, Victor, thanks very much for the phone call.
All right. It's a good subject. Thank you.
We're talking today with two firefighters about what it's like to get the call and head to the fire lines. If you've been there, we'd like to hear your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you can also share your experiences on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the past 2 weeks, almost 800 square miles of California have burned. Residents in some areas were told to evacuate, and 20,000 men and women worked to stop, slow, or reroute the flames. Today, our focus is on them. If you've been on the fire lines, call and tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can share your experiences on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guests are Del Walters, Assistant Regional Chief of the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, and Bill Payne, the Deputy Chief of Flight Operations for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. And Bill Payne, I wanted to get back to you. You had that vivid description of these very big planes dropping down to very low altitudes to drop the fires. There's an awful lot of wind blowing around down there, and a lot of heat, too.
Well, that's true. That's why these larger aircraft do such a good job. They've got lots of weight, lots of momentum, and they're pretty capable of powering through it. Listening to your caller there, I started my career as a rotorhead, a helicopter pilot fighting fires, and we'd fly around all day with our doors off, and we'd come home smelling like smoke for a couple days. My kids used to love it when I'd come home and say, "Dad, you smell like a barbecue."
It must take a while to get the smell out of the helicopters, too.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, that's what we live for. That's our job, and most of us really enjoy it.
Is there, I think a lot of people may have seen that Richard Dreyfuss movie some years ago. Is it dangerous?
Of course it's dangerous. There's inherent risk in everything that we do, and the fact that the ground you're flying over is on fire doesn't help out. But we train our people very well. The equipment is, you know, it's just maintained unbelievably. We've got the greatest maintenance people in the world. So you mitigate it as much as you can. You evaluate and you do your risk assessments, and everybody wants to be home at night, and so you just take it slow and take it careful, and we do the best we can. We try to be safe, effective, and efficient.
Here's an email question from Craig in Chicago. I'd like to hear your guests talk about how these big fires can create their own weather. Del Walters, is that right, their own weather?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, what can occur, and you can see this on a satellite picture over Northern California pretty much every afternoon here for the last week or so. It depends on the amount of moisture in the air, but what I believe the caller is referring to, or the person that sent the email, is the fact that when you get that much heat rising up and taking with it moisture, it's sucking cooler air from the ground around it, and it can, in fact, what we call an ice cap forms. All that moisture goes into a higher elevation, much cooler air, and that's the situation I believe the caller is talking about. Also, as it burns through broken terrain, we get actual fire whirls that develop, again, from the same phenomenon, very much like a tornado on fire.
And Bill Payne, that obviously affects flight operations, too.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, the hot air moving around down on the ground generates its own winds. It can be unbelievably tricky, and especially working in the rugged mountainous terrains where you've got the extreme up and down drafts, flying one of our S2T tankers in that area can become, I call it the wee ride. It's a lot of bumps, and I got to say, though, we have the best tanker pilots in the world, and these guys are just, men and women are just the most ultimate professionals that you could hope for to have on your fire.
Let's get another caller on the line. Mary's with us from Fresno, California.
Hi. I fought fires in the early 80s in central Idaho, and I was one of the first women, certainly not the first, because there were pioneer women ahead of me who fought for it, but one of the first women on project crew fires, which are 20-person crews, and on hell attack, which is fire suppression with helicopters. And I just have to say that the experience was wonderful. I just loved every minute of it. There was no hint at all of that I shouldn't be there. The crew bosses, the fire bosses, everything was very well run and very safe. We would sometimes, if fire bosses thought that the fire might turn around and go in a weird place, you know, we just didn't go there. And the other really exciting thing, besides the camaraderie of being with people, is being on the night crew, where, you know, you can see the flames, but everything else is pitch black. And sometimes certain types of trees, they'll just blow up in flames, even though there's no flames around. They preheat, and then they blow up. And, you know, those kind of experiences for me were just wonderful. And I'll always be glad that I did that and I had the opportunity.
Bill Payne mentioned men and women pilots. And Del Walters, what percentage of your crews out there would you guess are female?
You know, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but we do have an awful lot of female firefighters in our department.
Okay.
And today, as I saw crews coming in from other parts of the nation, women were well represented in those crews.
Mary, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Here's an email from Aliyah in California. I listened to your guest regarding the fires here in California. You asked him who were the people fighting the fires, and he mentioned everybody except the prisoners in the CDCR fire camps throughout California. These inmates work very hard and are very capable, and I wonder why he forgot to mention these very important resources. Prisoners, inmates are out there on the crews as well?
Yes, certainly. We have an excellent cooperative relationship with the Department of Correction and Rehabilitation, and it is truly one of our finest resources and a great program in the state of California.
Are they out on the fire lines, or are they there in a support role?
Oh, they're absolutely on the fire lines. These people get right down on the fire line. And a lot of the very rugged areas that we're talking about where this lightning has occurred, we can't use our dozers in there. And so our inmate firefighter crews are working alongside the firefighters from the United States Forest Service, Park Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Bureau of Land Management. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out, and the military. We brought in the military and some crews there as well.
Let's get Josh on the line. Josh with us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Hi, everybody. I'm glad to be talking to you guys. I was a forest firefighter in Missouri with the Forest Service when I was in AmeriCorps for a year. And I was just thinking I'd call and tell you guys about how the first time I ever did a forest fire, I got in the truck and I didn't know what to expect, and they threw in Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire and floored it down the highways, and I got there and didn't know what kind of equipment to expect very much. I mean, I had my training and everything, but they hand you a bandana and a rake and say, put out the fire if you see one around. So it's pretty amazing.
Just a bandana and a rake.
Yeah. You just need a fire, you rake around it, and that's about it. So you know, you got your fire equipment on and everything like that, but for the most part, you stand there with a fire with a bandana and a rake.
Del Walters, I guess sometimes the most simplest equipment is the most appropriate.
Well, in fact, it is, and we still put the fires out. You know, we appreciate the assistance that we get from the air. You still got to put it out on the ground. I will say we've come a long way in our fire training since I started, and what was just described there is not too far from the training that I received when I was first a firefighter in the early 70s. But we put our firefighters through pretty rigorous training before they're ever allowed on a fire engine these days.
Thanks very much for the call, Josh.
Thanks, everybody.
Bill Payne, I've heard of smoke jumpers. Is that part of your service, or is that part of Del Walter's service?
Well, the state of California doesn't have any smoke jumpers. The U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management have smoke jumpers. However, in a situation like this, or cooperative agreements, the smoke jumpers are certainly active throughout the state on these incidents. But that's a federal function rather than a state function at this point.
And I assume they have to pick very specialized spots to use that limited resource.
Oh, absolutely. You're gonna put the smoke jumpers in places where nobody else can go, and that's their function and that's their specialty. And we train with them every year. We have a special class up in Redding, California in May, where we do a joint exercise with all of the aerial resources, and the smoke jumpers are a big part of that.
Here's an email from Rick in California. Can your guest speak to the help in imaging hotspots that NASA's unmanned aircraft are providing the California firefighters? Del Walters, is that a resource you're using?
Yes, I can take that one. We have, last year during the siege that we had in October in Southern California, we probably brought in more remote sensing tools than I have ever seen on any incident. And we learned a lot from that and are employing them here as well. The NASA's Icona aircraft has been flying. We've been getting infrared imagery from satellites and also some fixed-wing manned aircraft or staffed aircraft. But and we've also flown some other unmanned aviation assets to gather the information on these fires.
Let's get Roger on the line. Roger's calling us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Yes, I was noodling around on some of the message boards up there, and it seemed to be this huge conflict between Cal Fire and the local fire departments about who can and can't participate. I was wondering if you could shed some light on that.
Is that an issue, Del Walters?
I haven't heard that one. I haven't had much time to be on the blogs here lately and forums. One of the things that we have to watch for as people start getting tired is they do get cranky. And as far as excluding local government from these fires, I can assure you that there is a huge representation from local government and volunteer fire companies on these incidents.
But there can be tensions in some incidents, I'm sure.
Certainly. There's a lot of frustration. I mean, there's just too much fire to go around initially. And we still have some of these fires, especially in the backcountry. I say we, mostly our federal partners on the national forests have some unstaffed, and we just can't get to them. So we have to prioritize very carefully based on life threat, property threat, infrastructure, and that sort of thing as we meet out the resources. But
yeah,
there is frustration. There's no doubt about it.
Okay. Roger, thanks very much. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Letty. Letty's with us from Sonora in California.
Yes. Hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay. I just heard the comment about the shortage of resources, and I can tell you from working in support dispatching that that is very, very true right now, especially. And it's not just resources nationally, but just within California. We had a lot of difficulty in manning all the open positions, getting the right equipment up here. And
Letty, when you say we, who are you talking about?
The dispatch organization here on the Stanislaus National Forest.
Is that where you work?
Yes, and we are supporting the North Mountain Fire, which is just about 95% contained. And now we're reassigning equipment and overhead to be going to some of the other incidents that are in need of our resources.
It must be a satisfying moment when you could start diverting the people and the equipment that you've been using on one fire and say, all right, now you can, it's good enough. We've got that. You can go work somewhere else.
It really is, and it's even though I don't work on the fire line, I know we contribute a lot into getting people to the fire line and getting them fed, getting them equipment that they need, and supplying them. But it was quite a struggle at first. I mean, we have to order our aircraft support every day because our South Ops, who is the Southern California Coordination Center, has to evaluate all the orders that come in for aircraft and decide who needs it the most and where it can be more effective.
Bill
so
Payne,
how
involved are you in that decision? Do other people decide where you should drop, or do you say, no, we'd be better off over there?
Well, from my point of view and from where all the pilots are, we're assigned to specific incidents. Like the caller said, the Northern or the Southern Operations Center, they set their priorities, and then the air assets are assigned to those incidents. It becomes a decision between the incident commander, the air tactical group supervisor, and the duty chief, what assets stay where. You could have a large fire going and then have another fire break out, and you may have to divert some of your assets to keep that small fire small before you have two big fires. So there's a lot of decision-making, a lot of priority setting in these decisions on where to send the assets. And sometimes they don't get manned, and sometimes we make mistakes and put too many things on one thing and not enough on the other, but we're doing the best we can to get the assets where they're most needed.
Letty, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And congratulations on containing the fire.
Thanks.
We're talking about firefighters amid the wildfires in California. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Harry's on the line. Harry's with us from Wisconsin.
Hello, Dale.
Hi, Harry.
I'm currently in a Wisconsin Division of Forestry Type 6 engine headed to our location that we're going to ship a strike team of engines to California from.
So what when you say a Type 6 engine, what's that?
Well, it's a 4x4 dually pickup. This one holds 150 gallons of water and has a variety of hose and other attachments for firefighting.
And normally would be used there in Wisconsin, but because of the emergency in California, you're sending it west.
Well, our fire season is usually in the spring. We're green right now, and we can afford, along with a number of other states throughout the country, to support California and Southwest fire situations, yes.
And you're going along with it?
I will catch up with it in a few days, yes. We have five of these engines, a strike team currently headed there, each of them staffed with two Wisconsin firefighters.
And Del Walters, where might Harry be sent?
Well, I'm glad to hear that Harry's coming and his troops. Our priority fires today, actually, the number one priority, let me back up a little bit. One of the things that Bill Payne said, initial attack, the new fires that pop up, those are the ones that are the highest priorities. And he may end up on one of those. The Gap fire down in Santa Barbara that started yesterday is the number one priority in the state right now. But I would think perhaps Butte County or Shasta County, these are northern counties in California, but we certainly still got plenty of fire left that when Harry's able to catch up with his people out here, we'll still have plenty for you to do.
And when it comes to be fire season in Wisconsin, might California be sending some engines there?
Well, if they have a big enough need, then we're willing to come.
Harry, have a great trip.
So thank you much.
And good luck to you.
Thank you, Harry.
We'll see you soon.
And gentlemen, thank you so much for your time today. Del Walters, you've obviously made a lot of progress on the fires. We appreciate the effort and congratulate you.
Thank you very much. And Neil, if you don't mind, if any of those firefighters, all of the firefighters who are listening in today, I want to extend my personal appreciation for everything that you're doing out there because I certainly know how tough it is.
Del Walters, Assistant Regional Chief of the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, with us today from his office in Redding, California. Again, thanks to him. And Bill Payne, we appreciate your time today, too.
My pleasure, Neil, and I'd like to send a message out to all the aerial firefighters. Stay safe and keep the greasy side down.
Bill Payne, Deputy Chief of Flight Operations for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, and he joins us today from California Public Radio in Sacramento, California. Coming up, the battle between pilot and technology to decide who gets to land on the moon. Digital Apollo is next. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are the headlines from some of the stories we're following here today at NPR News. The U.S. economy lost jobs for the sixth straight month in June. The Labor Department says employers trimmed a total of 62,000 jobs from their payrolls. The nation's unemployment rate, which comes from a separate survey, was unchanged at 5.5%. And U.S. provided technical assistance to the Colombian military during the rescue operation that freed 15 hostages, including three American military contractors and a French-Colombian politician yesterday. The hostages had been in the custody of the left-wing Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or the FARC. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, it's Science Friday, and Ira Flato will be here talking baseball bats, whether maple bats should be benched, and how a tiny bug may be throwing the bat-making industry a curveball, plus bottle or tap, a look at water, and why the source matters. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. In the spring of 1981, I sat next to retired General Chuck Yeager at Edwards Air Force Base in California. I was the producer assigned to cover the landing of the first space shuttle, and the famous test pilot was our expert commentator. One morning, he was about to be interviewed by Bob Edwards on Morning Edition, and there was a piece about the history of the space program on just ahead. As he heard Bob mention that Alan Shepard wrote a Mercury capsule to become the first American in space, Yeager leaned over to whisper, "Yeah, after they swept the monkey crap off the seat." He used another word. But in a way, he was right. A chimpanzee flew in a Mercury capsule before a human did, and any number of books and movies have told the story of the contempt that fighter and test pilots had for astronauts that they called passengers. Well, they, of course, were pilots themselves, and the astronauts became determined to act and be seen as acting as true pilots. Now, a new book tells that story from the engineer's point of view and tells a very different story. It's called Digital Apollo, Human and Machine in Spaceflight, and the book is also the basis of a documentary that airs next Tuesday night on the Discovery Channel as the second in a six-part series on moon machines. Author David Mindell joins us in just a moment. If you have questions about how those decisions were made and about the extent that politics, pilots, and technology played in them, our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. David Mindell is Dibner Professor of History of Engineering and Manufacturing at MIT and joins us today from a studio on the campus of Yale University at New Haven, Connecticut. And David, thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
And how much truth is there in that familiar story of astronauts who wanted to fly missions themselves fighting against engineers who wanted computers to control the whole thing?
Well, there's a lot of truth to that story. It's an old story in aviation, and one of the things that I uncovered in doing the research in the book that was sort of lost in space history was how much the astronauts wanted to fly the rockets straight off the pad by hand. And their idea of space flight was a lot like taking off in a large airplane off of a runway. And they argued and fought and tested and presented data for the ability to launch the rockets off the pad. And then some of the engineers really supported that, but others, particularly people like Wernher von Braun, came in and said, "Don't even think about flying one of my rockets off the launch pad. It's all completely automated. Everything that happens is so fast that a human being will be an unnecessary appendage during that period."
And that idea of the unnecessary appendage, well, in what situations did they learn that human judgment was really needed?
Well, in that same speech, actually, von Braun held out the possibility that once the pilots get into space, they'll really be critical. And the book sort of follows all the different arguments for the places where human judgment was seen as important. In Rendezvous, for example, which was famously first attempted during the Gemini project, Rendezvous was seen as the great human manual skill requiring judgment and vision and all these things on the part of the pilots. Of course, today a lot of Rendezvous are done automatically. But as the Apollo program came forward, and especially after the pilots lost the battle to launch the rockets off the pad, they fought very hard to have a literally a hand in the landing. And in some sense, the critical moments of the Apollo program were these last even 5 minutes, or in many cases 1 or 2 minutes, where the pilots were actually manually controlling the spacecraft. But of course, manual is a bit of a misnomer there, because they were really just commanding a computer with a joystick, and the computer was mediating their control of the spacecraft.
Nevertheless, yeah, we'll get back to that in a minute. It's an important point. But you begin the book by describing, again, another familiar story, the first landing on the moon, Apollo 11, but again, with a different emphasis.
Yeah, the Apollo 11 story, the famous story is that there was this 1202 program alarm a few thousand feet above the Earth, and the computer was restarting, or rebooting in modern terms. And Neil Armstrong turns off the computer and seizes manual control and brings it in for a safe landing. And NASA and quite a bit of the press narrated that story as technology fails and the human ultimately triumphs. And in fact, the ground controller who gave Armstrong the go on that landing was awarded by President Nixon the same time that the astronauts were. But as I began doing the research on the book and I talked to the engineers who built that computer, they were all highly offended by that version of the story. They felt that there had been a problem that had been actually caused by the astronauts following a checklist that was in error, and the computer had done all kinds of wonderful things in order to save the mission. And the real bug in the system overall was not in a piece of computer code, but it was a bug in the complex human organizational system on the ground that created this very rich, complicated technology.
Interesting that after Armstrong took over and landed manually, sort of using the software to actually control the spacecraft, every other astronaut who landed on the moon took over himself and landed manually.
That's true. And in the book, in the end of the book, I compare all six of these landings and the reasons that the astronauts give for why they felt it necessary to intervene and to turn off. There was a kind of automatic targeting that they always turned off, which was not entirely unexpected by the engineers on the ground. But they always said, well, the computer couldn't tell if we were taking us into a bad area and there were rocks and boulders. I could see. I relied on my vision, which the computer didn't have, to find a good area. But actually, the computer system they had, they could have directed the automatic targeting to any area they chose, but they always conflated the ability to see and to judge with the necessity to manually control the spacecraft.
In a way, there was, well, you describe it as not just machismo, but dignity of their profession.
I think so. There was a long history, which, again, I was a little bit surprised to uncover when I was researching the book, in a sense going back to the Wright brothers, about how much of flight is built into the machine by the engineer and how much of flight is created by the human pilot. And engineers and pilots were constantly tussling over the course of the 20th century about this question. And in the 50s, it really became critical as electronics and then analog computers came into cockpits. And your story opening up about Chuck Yeager comes out of that period where the classical pilots are people like Yeager, who are not college educated, they're not trained as engineers, they're real sort of seat of the pants type pilots. And then other pilots come in during that period, particularly people like Neil Armstrong, many of the later astronauts, not quite the Mercury astronauts, but they're educated at college, they're trained as engineers. These are technical people. And there's a lot of debate about just who is a pilot. Is he a hands-on sort of craft person who uses this sort of manual, inherent, intuitive skill to fly? Or is he a systems manager? That was the buzzword from the 50s. Someone who sort of a white-collar job where they oversee and they use what today we would call essentially a knowledge worker. And this debate is very, very current even before Sputnik launches. And then that's the sort of world that Yeager and the Mercury astronauts and sort of Tom Wolfe's Wright Stuff sort of story comes into.
We're talking with David Mendel of MIT about his book Digital Apollo, which traces the creation of the first digital guidance computer used in the Apollo landings and the Apollo missions. It's also the basis for a documentary to air on the Discovery Channel on Tuesday night, part of a six-part series on moon machines. If you'd like to join on the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. This is Phil, and Phil's with us from Salt Lake City.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'd just like to add a couple points here. One was that what are called now, in retrospect, onboard computers would have essentially in today's terms, have the same power as a $20 or a $40 scientific calculator. And the other is, I'd like the author to comment on two times where astronauts successfully overrode computers and saved missions, one with Wally Schirra in Gemini 6 or 7, and the other with Neil Armstrong when they were coming in for a landing and had to cross over a boulder field.
Now, he's mentioned Neil Armstrong already, but David Mindell?
Yeah, on the first point, and this is something you hear constantly about the Apollo computer, it had less computing power than a digital calculator or a wristwatch today, which is true if you measure the power of the computer strictly by the number of machine cycles or the amount of memory. But if you look at questions like reliability and the quality of the software and the degree to which it had been thought through, it was really quite an impressive piece of hardware. In fact, well, more so because of the relative slowness of the computer. I mean, who among us today would stake our lives on our computer running for 2 weeks without a single flaw? Yet that's exactly what the astronauts in Apollo did. And the Apollo computer, reliability was a huge part of what they were doing. And again, before that, computers were these large, clunky things. They failed all the time. And the Apollo computer made the use of this innovative thing called an integrated circuit, a silicon chip, in order to make a computer that would actually run and be essentially the size of a suitcase, which was a rather radical thing for that period.
And
as far as the
Wally Schirra?
The Gemini 6 mission, what he's referring to is a moment where the rocket essentially misfired, and Wally Schirra was in the capsule at the time, and according to the mission rules, he should have pulled the abort handle, which would have ejected the astronauts from the rocket while it was on the launch pad, assuming that the rocket was going to explode, and would have ideally flown them back to safety, but was a very dangerous, risky operation and really would have ruined the mission. And what Schirra sensed was that actually the rocket hadn't left the pad at all, not even an inch, and that his checklist was erroneous, and he overrode the checklist and chose not to abort the mission at some risk to his own life. But in the end, he saved the mission because it was then a rather routine matter to fix that problem and move the other day. And there are many examples throughout these programs of machines failing and people fixing them in one way or another. And, you know, John Glenn's mission is a classic case where Glenn said, you know, without a man in the cockpit, there was no chance to bring the capsule back. Of course, he didn't mention if there wasn't a human in the capsule, there would have been no need to bring the capsule back. And there's always this kind of conversation throughout Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and then well into the space shuttle era as well.
Phil, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about Digital Apollo. Our guest is David Mindell, its author. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get James on the line. James with us from Norfolk in Virginia.
Yes, sir. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I've got a question for your guest. I'm a Hornet pilot, and I'm curious if you did any research on modern aviation and the debate between whether a pilot is a craftsman and or an engineer is still a very valid and current debate, and you know, it plays into our tactics and the design of upcoming aircraft. And I'd be curious to see what he thought about that.
David?
That's actually a really good question, a very good point. And I talk a little bit in the end of the book about how this issue, in a sense, this book is all about Apollo and the Apollo computer and the Apollo landings, but it's really about this larger question, which is very much part of aviation today. Glass cockpits, fly-by-wire, all sorts of computerized systems raise this exact question about are pilots craftsmen? Are they managers? You know, I say pilots are a little bit like baseball players in that they make a lot of money, but they also form labor unions and go on strike. They live in this kind of a netherworld between blue collar and white collar, and they've always been in that spot. And they're not the only ones in that position. You know, architects use computers to design buildings and maybe never make a drawing in their entire career. Or surgeons maybe are using robots to do surgery, whereas the manual skill of the surgeon used to be the special thing that set them apart. And the book really gets at this larger question of, as we begin building intelligent systems of different kind, and we can all debate what level of intelligence they really are, how does that change the human identity associated with those particular tasks? Anything from surgery to, in some cases, the word processing you do on your desktop.
But some people, and James is probably familiar with this conversation, feel that maybe the next generation of fighter aircraft will be the last generation of manned fighter aircraft.
Well, you know, exactly, and that's why I was calling, and maybe I'm biased, but I think there's certain things that that you need a person for, but I guess that's the same argument that the Apollo astronauts were making.
Yes, I guess so. James, thanks very much. Fly safe.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. David Mendel, there's also politics in this book. You define it as the difference between science and exploration.
Yeah, in some sense. I mean, the Apollo mission was a political mission at its core. So many of the engineers who worked on the computers and the control systems, if you had asked them, could you land a vehicle on the moon, they could say, of course, we don't need an astronaut for that. In fact, there were unmanned probes that landed on the moon before any Apollo astronauts landed there. But, of course, Kennedy's famous challenge to the nation, send a man to the moon and return him safely to Earth, requires that a human be in the loop. So there's no possibility of accomplishing that mission without a human in the capsule. And that was ultimately a political mission. And Kennedy was very conscious about using lots of classic American imagery of frontiers and new frontiers. And, well, who lives on frontiers? Frontiersmen, you know, one of the great American mythological characters. Cowboys, of course, is one way they're often spoken about. And that sort of the idea that Apollo was to prove that the heroic human American male individual skilled still had a role to play in this world and could conquer these various forces was, you know, one of the major goals of the mission. And so that's one of the things that's fascinating about this book as I look in the really technical part about how are they writing the software and what did the little computer chips actually do. But at every point, it's related to what are the politicians trying to do? What is the president saying? And they make this distinction, which in some ways is still a distinction in debates about NASA, about science, where you're trying to collect data about the natural world and learn about physical principles and learn about the universe, and exploration, which they define as human. And exploration throughout history has always been including science, but also having lots of other things like state power and cultural capital and risk and reward and human presence. And it's a much more complicated equation than simply going out and collecting some data.
Let's get one last call in. Stuart's with us from Miami. We just have a few seconds left, Stuart.
Yes, there's an apropos joke that the cockpit crew of the airliner at the near future will consist of a pilot and a dog. The pilot's job is to feed the dog, and the dog's job is to bite the pilot if he tries to touch the controls.
Okay. Thanks very much, Stuart. Appreciate the phone call. But indeed, there are systems in commercial aircraft that can land big planes quite safely, they say.
And they're used periodically. They use them more in Europe than they do in the United States. The space shuttle has a fully automatic landing system that's never used. The pilots always still intervene manually at the last moment and land the space shuttle by hand. That's a little bit of a vestige of the same kind of idea in Apollo. And there are legitimate technical reasons for that. And there's a legitimate technical debate about how involved people should be. And my point is really that when you talk about human spaceflight, you're taking this issue on head on, and it's an issue that's been around for a long time. And the way that it's been debated in public discourse is a little bit of a distraction, and really needs to be debated in a different way.
David Mendel, Dibner Professor of History of Engineering and Manufacturing at MIT, with us today from Yale University in New Haven. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
We've been talking about Digital Apollo. Ira Flatow's here tomorrow with Science Friday. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.